When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. If you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. Use the Stamps.com mobile app to mail everything you need to keep your business running with up to 89% off USPS and UPS. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Use code PROGRAM for a special offer. That's Stamps.com, code PROGRAM.
Good afternoon, good morning, good evening, wherever you are in the world. I'm Russell Tovey.
And I'm Robert Diamant.
And this is Talk Art.
Welcome to Talk Art.
How are you, Robert?
Today, Russell, I am feeling laid back and cozy and comfy, and I've been hanging out on my own for a number of days in my house, and it got me thinking about the designs, the interior designs of today's guest, which are known for around the world for being incredibly elegant and chic, but at the same time, very livable and laid back and comfortable.
Would you say they were cool, calm and collective?
Well, I would say they are casually elegant. Actually.
Oh, okay, very good. That's like you, basically.
Seriously, that's the reason why I know we're going to get on so well with today's guest. He is interior design royalty and has designed houses all over the world, but predominantly in America, where he's based. And we're speaking to him today, I think, from New York. And he's also based in the Hamptons and has done many homes across America, but also London. I saw he did one in London, which was super exciting. So closer to home.
I didn't know that. That's cool.
Yeah, very cool. So we would like to welcome to Talk Art,
Robert Stilling.
Hi, Robert.
Good afternoon, gentlemen. How are you?
Good. How are you?
We're really good. Good.
I'm great too. Very, very chill and laid back in my apartment in Soho.
Awesome.
That's amazing. It's snowing there, right, at the minute?
We already had snow. We have a little bit of snow still on the ground, but no snow today.
That's good. Well, we're all completely locked down here in the UK. Tier 4. Every country has shut its borders to us. We're like hemmed in. We are Wuhan.
Well, we could be next. Right, so, now. Yeah.
Yeah. Crazy times. So we find you in New York in your apartment that we would have seen featured heavily on your Instagram feed.
Absolutely.
What's it like for you in your apartment today? What are you surrounded by right now?
At this exact moment, I'm in my guest bedroom that is also sort of a home office and became more of a home office during COVID when I was quarantining here for the first 2.5 months. And we are surrounded by a beautiful custom bed that I designed in cashmere from Laura Piana, a fantastic 1960s Scandinavian desk, and a lot of art on the walls and on the tables and a whole mix of
things. Let's talk about the art. What art have you got up there?
I have a beautiful 1960s, it's not really pop art. It's very graphic. It has dimension to it. It could remind you of like a minimalist Frank Stella. And the artist's name is Sven. I can't think of his last name. It's a fabulous, fabulous painting that I found from a friend of mine who's an antique dealer. And it wasn't particularly expensive. And I just saw it and I was like, wow, that is amazing. I could see Axel Vervoort having this, you know, in Belgium in the castle. Or So I bought it for like $5,000.
You're going to have to talk about that reference you've just brought up then, because a lot of our listeners will not know who Axel Vervoort is. And that's spelled H-J-O-R-T-H is the surname, isn't it? Is that how you say it?
Vervoort, it's V-E-R-V-O-O-R-D-T.
Got it. So tell us about him.
Axel is, you know, from Belgium, from Antwerp, and he is sort of like created what you would call the Belgian look, kind of that has been widely, widely copied all over the world, particularly by Restoration Hardware, by lots of people, but no one does it like he does. And the thing that I would say is unique about Axel is that he creates this incredible mood that's a combination of like the history of Europe, the minimalism and sort of depth of Asia mixed with contemporary art and just like incredible furniture, you know, 18th century, 19th century, 20th century, 21st century. And he just, his work is very soulful and very kind of like old school on the one hand and classic with strong architecture, but also very, you know, 21st century at the same time. I don't know if that makes sense.
He has booths and art fairs now. I think his family have a gallery, don't they, as well, where they can do.
Yeah, his son Boris runs the gallery in Antwerp, and they do shows all over the world, and they also do design fairs for Axel Verwoerd because he has this incredible. It's not really a shop. It's like a. It's hard to say. Like, I mean, their home, not so much anymore, but their home. Is basically a castle, and they call it the castle. And for years, that was kind of like you would go to their house and you would see this incredible, beautiful castle filled with furniture and art and everything was kind of for sale. And then later they bought this place called the Canal, which was this old sort of industrial grain storage place. And they turned that into their studios and these incredible galleries filled with furniture and art and everything was, you know, for sale, and which is still there, but that also became eventually a real estate development, and they worked with all the sort of best architects of the day and created like this beautiful real estate complex with residential living and et cetera, et cetera.
Wow. So it's like you're buying into a lifestyle, the way you're describing that then, which feels like is kind of when we come to Robert Stilling Designs and we look at your interiors, you're kind of projecting yourself into this lifestyle that you're creating.
Absolutely. In fact, it's funny that you say that because I tell people that that's what I do. I create lifestyles for people. I create their lifestyle, not a pre-prescribed one, but one that's unique to them.
So how does that work then? How do you get clients then? If you're sitting down with a client and you have to assess what their style is and you're not imposing your taste too much onto them, how do you set that up?
Well, it's most of my clients come to me through referral, so there's always some kind of a connection, not always, but most of the time, that, you know, sort of establishes a certain sense. You know, if they are familiar with my work and they liked other people's houses or apartments, then that's a good start. And then after that, it's really about me sort of spending time with them and getting to know them and being around them. And I just have this visceral ability to absorb people, to listen to people and absorb what they say. And I ask them a lot of questions and I just get a sense of who they are, how they want to live, etc. And it's almost as if I say it's visceral because when I'm out shopping, I there's this part of me that becomes them, like I'm shopping for them, even though it's me and I'm editing it from my perspective as well. It's really kind of like, I mean, I never went to school for architecture or design or art or any of these things that I do. And so for years, I just did it and I never thought about it. And then as I got older and I got a little bit more accomplished and more recognized, people started asking me to talk about stuff. And I had never thought about it, but and then one day some editor said to me, Robert, you can't just keep saying the same thing. You need to get a little deeper. So these kinds of things that we're doing right now, you know, over the past 10 years have allowed me to sort of like understand what I do more. And it's sort of that. It's really I absorb people and then I give them back a better version of themselves.
Yeah, it's like you're an interior clairvoyant. You're channeling something them whenever you're building their homes.
You know, I've always found it really interesting with Russell because he's the person that got me into interiors. And there's definitely something connecting to his acting, like, job. Right. You know, in the way that he sort of inhabits different people's personalities and characters in his roles. And also the film sets. And when he got into what you do, because he was showing me a lot of your interiors that you'd done for different people's homes about a year ago now or so. So I remember thinking that they almost look in photographs like film sets. There's something really like filmic about what you do. And there's they're very real, yeah. And also like the lighting in them and the textures. And I often see that you've got like mohair carpets or mohair rugs and things. Like there's all these kind of...
Rob loves mohair.
I love mohair.
I like alpaca even better. And
oh, really?
I like... cashmere is like probably my favorite. So, and I'm very into like texture and the way things feel. And really, like, the first and foremost thing that's the most important to me is comfort. Like, if I make something that's beautiful, that's not comfortable, I failed. And I think that, you know, a lot of people who aren't my clients have been to a lot of my clients' homes, and, you know, things come back to me, they call me or whatever, and they're like, you know, wow, you know, that house has got a great art collection, but, like, it's so comfortable too. I didn't want to leave. That's what I do. That's wow. Those are the kinds of things. I love hearing that, because, you know, it's, yeah. That's a success. If you can have all these amazingly beautiful sculptural, architectural, you know, things that you surround yourself with, but you can have them in a way that you can also live your life, and you can do a Zoom call with, or you can do a podcast with people in London, or you can do a Zoom with someone in LA, or you can have a dinner party or whatever, but you can be comfortable all the time doing that. You can, you know, play tennis and still sit on the sofa and, you know, whatever it is, all those kinds of things. Like, that's a successful life to me. It's not just about making it, you know, good looking.
Yeah, well, I've got a quote here that says, I like homes to feel very real. I'm not interested in creating show places.
Correct. That's true.
Yeah.
I said,
because all your images, it's like there's piles of books. It feels like someone's just gone, get out the picture. I need to take a photo of this. It feels like it's happening. It's like that's what's so beautifully styled around your interiors. So how did you get into it? Because I've heard this amazing story about you having a shop and then someone buying everything from the shop and then saying to you, design my 6,000 square foot house. And you're like, okay.
It's true. It's actually two stories. Mm-hmm. So there's one story, which is true, of I'd had a shop in Palm Beach for maybe like 6 months, and then I closed it over the summer when this is back in the days when Palm Beach really closed up. And then I reopened it, had a new debut the next season in a different location, which was this stunning Meisner house in a via called Via Parigi in Palm Beach. It was owned by this very, like, sort of eccentric, super wealthy couple. And the lower level was very suitable for a shop, and they lived on the five stories above it. Anyway, it had these, you know, beautiful architecture, whatever. Anyway, so like I was opening up on a Saturday, I think, with a party, and maybe on Monday, Tuesday, I set the place up. And on Wednesday, this very recognizable woman named Ms. Maxwell, I'm going to say that because I could never pronounce her first name, who's, you know, been quite famous in the news. Yes, exactly.
Oh my God.
She came in and she was looking at my store, and she was like, I like that, and I like that, and I like that, and I like that. And it happened to be a bunch of things, but in particular, a lot of upholstered furniture. And I was very new to this business. I wasn't even doing design at the time. And I had, you know, you had to order this stuff. I wasn't going to sell it off the floor. So I was like, okay, great. This is fantastic. Like, you know, it's be 4 to 6 weeks. And she said, oh no, I want this delivered to my house tomorrow. So here I am, like, ready to open my store. And she's sitting there saying, basically, I want to buy almost everything you have. And I was like, oh no, you know, like, what do I do? So of course I sold it all to her, and she bought it and was all delivered to Mr. Epstein's house. So there's that story. That's a true story.
Oh my God. Is that out in public? Is that something you've spoken about before?
I don't think I've ever said it on a podcast before, but I've definitely said it before.
Oh my God.
Wow. Yeah.
Yes, it's breaking news. You heard it here first.
Wow.
It's a scoop.
Have you ever seen any of your interiors in the background of any of these, like, incriminating photos?
No, not that I know.
Oh, no. God.
But I didn't, like, all I did was sell her the furniture. She was really putting it all together, and I never, we were not even allowed in the house. We, like, got a truck, we brought it all over there, it was put in, and that's the way it was. So then the second story is that, yes, somebody came into my shop. I think it was maybe later in that season, like, probably, like, March or April, and they liked a lot of stuff, and they bought it, and they said, we like all this stuff, and we bought a house, could you help us? And so that was my first kind of job. And that sort of was the initial getting into interior design.
And now it's been 30 years.
Yeah, it's been 30 years. I did it and it went really well. And then I sort of was like, well, if I want to be a designer or an interior designer, how do I do this? And so I started researching it, and which was a lot, not as easy as today, but not that hard. And I kind of figured it out, and I figured out, like, oh, well, if people want to be designers, they do show houses. So I did I tried to get into this show house, which was kind of like a, at the time I was married and to a woman, and it was kind of like controlled by this gay mafia, and they were just not having it. They were like, no, we're so sorry, we're full, we have no rooms for you. So okay, fine, I got booted. And and then a couple of weeks later, the guy who was the head of it called me and said, someone, there's a room available now. Obviously someone had dropped out, and he knew that I had the resources to do it, and he was like, would you like to do it? So I did it. It got a lot of attention. But that was it. I never got a job. Nobody called me, whatever. And then maybe 6 months later, this woman called me on, you know, some a June morning and said, I have an apartment in Palm Beach. It's a penthouse. It's 5,000 square feet with 2,000 square feet of terraces. I saw your work at the show house last fall and I liked it. And I'm looking for a young designer who's ambitious. And, you know, are you interested? And I met with her and I ended up doing the apartment. And the thing that's interesting about it was that was my first really big project. They definitely, I was ambitious, and they definitely were looking for somebody, you know, young and less expensive. And I learned how to do construction on that project. But mostly that was my first foray into serious art. They, you know, were contemporary art collectors, and she kept telling me the whole time, like, you know, I'm not showing you the art. You can come and see my house, and you could my other house, and you could see my apartment and see the kind of art I have. But I'm not showing you any of the art. Just do it. I'm going to change it all the time. And then I did, and we did it. And, you know, at the time in Palm Beach, people were still mostly collecting like impressionistic art and all that kind of stuff. And very few people were collecting contemporary. And they were kind of, you know, most people were like, what is this weird stuff? But that collection in the early 90s had Sam Francis, Frank Stella, Nan Golden, Cindy Sherman. Just I could go on and on and on. They had a Leland Sheep, which nobody was buying then, on and on and on. So that was my first real big job working with art, and which was a really, you know, unplanned and great opportunity.
It's interesting because I think your career has actually kind of grown during a time when the two disciplines have really come together more than ever before. Because I think with the development of, even if you think of like Design Miami and the art fairs and how that's all now being positioned like directly, you know, side by side. But I read you in another interview discussing this idea that like it's a total natural fit because, you know, if you're going to be interested in collecting art, then you will also be interested in thinking about furniture, and that they should coexist in a really livable, you know, positive way.
100%. I completely agree with that. And I do think that every year that goes by, we're in that moment, or the moment is there that gets larger and larger and larger, where the combination of art and design is definitely happening more and more. Having said that, you would be shocked at how many people have amazing art collections that don't have houses that are very nice, or people who have stunning architecture who don't have good art and good design, or they have great design and the house isn't that great and the art's not that great. In fact, I've been on panels before to discuss that. The people who really get it all right, in the totality of 7 billion people on this planet, is a very, very, very small number. But because of what you're saying, it is growing. People are a lot more educated. There's a lot more access, a lot more exposure, and people are getting more sophisticated about it, which is great. I love it.
Do you feel an intimidation from the art world, or any disdain from the art world towards designers?
30 years ago, yes, I absolutely did. Right. And it was exactly that. It was like, oh, you're a decorator. Oh, you're a designer. What do you want? What do you know? And I would say that today, that's a very, very different thing.
Right.
I think that the galleries court designers, and certainly I, you know, have developed very, very strong relationships with all the galleries, and that I think they all have a lot of respect for me, and I've, you know, had a lot of gallerists come to my projects and be impressed, and et cetera, et cetera. You know, yeah, I think it's very, very different.
I guess you take on an art advisor role. If you're working with clients and they want to build like an art collection, if they look at what you collect and your influences and your connections, I guess in some ways you are working as a curator for their houses, as an art advisor.
We do the whole gamut. We have people who are serious collectors that have been collecting for years and buy all their own art. We have collectors that are serious collectors and they have an art consultant. We have some that are aspiring serious collectors and they have an art consultant. We have clients who like my taste in art and I build collections with them, and I've built some very substantial collections with them. We have young people who, you know, come, or even middle-aged people who come and they're, you know, want to do something different in their life, and they not only want to have art, but they know that like art's part of the game, which is interesting because I just had this conversation yesterday with someone. You know, when I started in this business, it was very, very difficult to get most people to spend any money on art. You know, I got really lucky with this first client. It was amazing. But after that, you know, for the first 15 years, I did it and I pushed it, but it was a struggle. Now it's just an expectation. Like most sophisticated people who are going to hire someone like me and spend a considerable amount of money, they know that they have to have an art budget and they want to have an art budget.
What's your favorite type of collector? Someone who is already collecting or someone that you can help collect, or a young collector? When a client...
Yeah, I mean, the ideal is someone who is aspirational. Someone who's collected for a really long time tends to be a problematic client. They're already have a level of expertise and oftentimes, and if they're a big collector, they tend to, you know, it ends up being like a competition, and somehow that's not really that gratifying. It's more gratifying to be with someone who, you know, they're learning from you. I learn so much from my clients too. There's an interchange. And maybe I learn things about them that are, you know, about, you know, business or, you know, that kind of stuff. And they're teaching me this kind of stuff. Yeah. And I'm teaching them about art and design and culture and all that kind of stuff. And it's a nice sort of interchange. I would say someone who's, you know, aspirational and wants to build a collection and they want to have, like, you know, a beautiful home or homes, and, you know, they want to have, you know, interesting furniture and design, and they want to live well and all that sort of stuff. Like, yeah, that's the best client for sure.
And what about your own collection? Because I noticed that you seem to have a lot of photography, and that seems to be like a big part of your collection, but you've even got amazing paintings by like Joan Mitchell. I saw is that your house, that one, the Joan Mitchell?
No, that's unfortunately not. I bought that for a client, but that's not mine. I wish it was.
God, I love that painting, because I was like, he's got beautiful. A Joan Mitchell from like 1958. It's exactly. Such a beautiful... I love that whole room as well.
Yeah.
But your own collection, how did that grow, and why photography?
I started collecting in the late 80s, and I that's all I could afford. You know, it was the most affordable thing at the time. And I also liked it a lot. And so that's kind of how I got into it. And I continue to collect photography. And I have a pretty big photography collection. I own like probably like, I don't know, several hundred photographs. And then most of the kind of like, you know, large scale artists and things like that that I like and would like to collect are outside of my budget. So maybe like about 6 or 7 years ago, I decided I was going to start collecting small paintings by important artists and that don't cost more than like $50,000, and that would be my opportunity to collect, you know, the important artists of the day in a way that I could afford it.
I saw an amazing work on paper by Stanley Whitney in one of the installations. And you obviously got that before Stanley was that well known, because I think it's an older one, no?
No, for sure. Yes. And I know Stanley. He's so nice, and his wife is fantastic. She's a great artist too.
Marina.
They're fantastic. Super nice people.
I love them both.
Who's in your photography collection? I know that you collect Wolfgang Tillmans, who's a former talk art guest and like my hero.
Yeah, I own a lot of his photographs. I own Richard Mizrock, Alex Soth, Frank Thiel, Mitch Epstein, Candida Hoffer. There's another Hoffer who is English, whose name I can't think right now, that I also own. Gursky. I have a lot of photography also that, you know, like I have an amazing photographer from Argentina named Santiago Porter that I own a bunch of photographs by. I have works by... I can't even remember all the names right now. A lot.
I read you had like 150 artists or something.
Yeah, something like that.
a huge collection, yeah.
And a lot of artists that I like, you know, who end up buying several works by them because I like them so much.
And what advice would you give to budding collectors or people who don't have huge budgets? Because I know you just said that you didn't have a huge budget to begin with, and that's why you went to photography. Because I noticed in one of the installations, you've actually got a series of prints by David Shrigley, which the company that I'm the director of, Counter Editions, we actually made those prints. And they're obviously, the idea behind that business is for affordable, you know, big names at affordable prices. What kind of advice? Because also I've seen amazing things you've done where you've like found vintage flags of different countries like America, sure, or the Union Jack from England, and, you know, really fun kind of ideas.
Well, I think you can definitely be creative. That's for sure the truth. And I think if you want to collect whatever you want to collect, if you want to collect art, photography, you want to collect ceramics, anything, like, you know, do a little research. You don't have to be in a rush. Go out and, you know, see as much as you can. Go to museums, go to galleries, go to flea markets, go to, you know, sales, all that kind of stuff, and sort of like figure out what you like, and then figure out based on like what you like what you can afford. And there's just, and today's, there's so much availability, and just, you know, the world is so open in terms of finding stuff. And I think, right, for me, that the way that I judge things more on like how I'm not an academic collector. I'm really like a visceral collector. And so for me, it's like, what does that piece make me feel like? What does it mean to me? How do I respond to it? That's the first thing. The second thing is, how much does it cost? Well, if it's $500 or $1,000, then I can say like, well, that's a pair of shoes or a cashmere sweater or whatever. And I might like this more than either of those things. And, you know, if it turns out to be worth something over time, that's great. And if it's just always only just worth $500 or $1,000 and I love it and I'm going to enjoy it, who cares? And then, yeah, just as the things get more and more expensive, you just have to like value, how do you value it? And then you get to a point where you like, you have to start doing research and checking out and making sure that, like, you know, it makes sense and all that. But overall, I don't believe in buying art to make money. I don't think it's a bad investment. I think it's been a great investment for myself and for a lot of my clients. But myself and most of my clients aren't buying it necessarily to make a good investment, yeah, out of it. But I've created collections for people.
Larry Gagosian gave you advice at one point, didn't he?
He 100% did. He says, he's known to say this. He said, you know, buy the best that you can buy it. If you like something and you can afford it, then buy it. You know, make the best deal you can, whatever, you know, whatever that is. But like, you know, I think that that's great.
Totally. Totally. So I think you might think like me, Robert, because a lot of my friends think I'm completely nuts, that they will come to my apartment one week and then they come to my apartment a couple of weeks later and they're like, you've moved everything around. There's different art up. You've moved that chair over there. That bowl suddenly somewhere else. You've then brought this bowl in. Do you get like a bit overwhelmed with just how much amazing kind of design and furniture and objects and art that you have, that you kind of change your interiors of your own personal spaces all the time?
Well, I completely understand what you're saying. And I,
yeah,
collect at that level that I have that many things. I don't change stuff probably as often as you do. I feel like I'm a Libra, and Libras are always seeking balance. And so my home for me is like a sanctuary, and it's a place for me to sort of have peace. And I spend my day making homes for other people, changing things around, putting them together, doing all that kind of stuff. And so when I get home, I don't really want to change stuff that much. I do. Mm-hmm. And I'll have like, you know, and usually it becomes the result of like, I have to do a photo shoot and it needs to look different, or yeah, you know, something like that. Or I'm going to have a party.
Yeah.
I'm having a party and I have a bunch of, you know, right now I have in my living room I have this salon style wall with two huge Wade Guytons and then about 20 other different things. And below it are probably 25 pieces of art that are, some are open, some are still in the boxes, that are all lined up there in a very stylish, artsy way. But, you know, I haven't even taken those things out of the box. So one day, you know, I'll call up my hanger or whatever, or I'll have somebody will be like, you know, they want to do a portrait here, or they want to, or something, or some magazine needs some new thing. And then I'll redo that whole wall with all that new stuff. And that's how kind of it happens for me.
You must feel a pressure though, like, constantly, because now your kind of calling card is your personal interiors. That you've got this amazing book out, Robert Stillen Interiors, which I've got in front of me, which is phenomenal. And the Wade Guyton's you were just talking about are on the cover. But you must have like a lot of people kind of judging your taste and style. Is that quite, do you feel the pressure now that you're at this, because you're, as Rob said, you're AD100 Architectural Digest 100 royalty, you are like the top of your game. Do you feel that pressure?
I don't really feel pressured, no. I mean, I really love what I do, and I don't really ever feel like it's work, and I do feel confident in my taste and my skill. And I mean, there might be some people who don't like what I do, and that's okay, or maybe they just don't understand it.
I'm joking. How would you define your taste?
My personal taste?
Yeah.
My personal taste, I would say, is it's based in all the things that I care about the most, which is really comfort and form and function. And then from there, it goes up to, like, you know, the aesthetic visual value. And then I would just say generally, I like warmth, comfort. I like, I definitely like things a little bit more masculine. I like things a little kind of like my art even tends to have a little bit of darkness in it. There are I own a lot of like beautiful photographs that people, oh, that's so beautiful. But then there's like a backstory that's a little dark behind it. And I'm attracted to that sort of things. I mean, I see like there's beauty in everything. There's beauty. Something could be sort of considered ugly, and then you could take a photograph of it and it can become this beautiful thing. And I appreciate that sort of thing. So my taste is like, it's definitely layered. And I think layering creates sort of like a sense of depth and character and a mix of like textures and materials. It creates interest. And so, and just warmth. Like I always say that today, if you live in a brand new home or apartment, or if you live in something that's even several hundred years old, that's been completely renovated, it's essentially new. And all the sort of like depth and character has been taken out of it. So these layers of like carpets layered on top of carpets, and cashmere bed, and an alpaca blanket, and, you know, beautiful ceramics, and all the art and salon style and all this kind of stuff, it creates a depth and layer that brings in some like a feeling of history and some kind of sense of purpose, that you're surrounded by something that makes you feel good, it makes you feel safe. And that's what I'm attracted to and what I kind of do. If that makes sense. I don't know if that makes sense, but
I really like the story of you've got a chair that you reupholstered, and you found it in a market, maybe in Paris or Berlin, definitely in Europe, and then you brought it to America, and then you reupholstered it in a kind of cowhide or something. And you were talking about how you live with that, and that you didn't sort of restore every part of it, so it still has the kind of history of its life before you had it.
Well, the truth is that I didn't reupholster it. No, this is, I'm talking about, that's like a Bogue Mogensen.
That's right.
1960s wing chair with the original leather on it. And yes, what it means is that, you know, that chair has had, let me see, 40, 50, 60 years of life. It has history. If you go and get a brand new chair and put it next to it, it has no history. It has no life in it. And when you, that's the beauty of like vintage furniture and antique furniture. It comes with a story. It comes with the past. It comes with generations or, you know, decades or whatever it is that has a soul to it. And all these different soulful things mixed together create something that has meaning versus as opposed to just like, you know, a white box or just like a new, everything is new and kind of antiseptic. Mm.
I think the word you used was patina.
Yes, patina, 100%.
Patina, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
I like patina, I prefer patina, but we call it patina.
patina's quite nice.
Sounds like my drag name.
It should be. Looking at all these interiors in your images, is that there's so many incredible furniture designers in there that I kind of appear a lot, like Jean Royer and Charlotte Perriand, Paul Kajaya Home, Pierre Jeanneret, Pierre Chapeau. These all feel like the masters of design that feed into all of your projects. Do you have, are they like, do you have staple designers that you go to and trust.
I mean, those are all, you know, those, a lot of those names are super fashionable right now, but I've been collecting them and using them at work for 30 years, which is fine. And, you know, I'm attracted to what I'm attracted to. And somebody recently asked me about trends and like, you know, and my answer was, I don't do trends. I don't believe in trends. I don't even know what a trend is, but, I really, for me, it's about, you know, what's the project, what's the need, what's the use, and all those kind of like more practical things. And then like, what do I like for that? And I'm really, that's how I'm sort of like acquiring things, buying things, putting things
who
together.
Who should we be looking at now then, Robert? If these are the people that are kind of fashionable now and you've been using them 30 years, who should we be looking at now? And how do you find these?
Now you're stressing me out. I'll tell you what, the next time I'm allowed to come to Europe, you can come and meet me in Paris and we'll go shopping in the markets and I'll tell you that you should buy that and you should buy that and you should buy that and then you'll know. I don't know for sure. I think that like brown furniture will have a resurgence. I think there's a lot of
brown furniture.
You know, like just like classic antique, like English furniture that's like mahogany with like a brown stain on it. That kind of stuff, like more traditional kinds of stuff. But I've always used it in my work, and if you really look at my book, you might not notice it so much because it tends to be a little bit more of a staple, and I'll take like a classic antique table and then I'll put like, you know, a modern lamp on it and some contemporary sculpture and, you know, beautiful books and all this kind of, and suddenly it's become this whole different thing, which is also, you know, something that I do and that I'm good at. I'm drawing all this stuff from the past, and I would never, like, I love Danish furniture, you know, 60s, 50s, 70s, all that stuff. But if you go back and you look at the books from that furniture when it was installed, I hate it. Like, it's just an entire room of Danish furniture. Not for me. I'm dumb. I have no interest. Just like, I'm not really attracted to like a period, you know, 18th century room particularly either. Maybe a little bit more so, but I wouldn't want to live in it. It's more about pulling things and then recreating something new for today and mixing it with technology and everything that we have in our lives today that didn't exist then. But a big element about it beyond the beauty and the aesthetics is it comfortable? Does it work? And also it has a soul.
Yeah.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. United Healthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello, this is Russell Tovey and Robert Diamond from Talk Art, the arts podcast. And we're here today with Budweiser beer. And we're going to be talking about something very, very important to both of us, aren't we, Rob?
That's right. Budweiser, the king of beers, has joined forces with legendary artist Sir Peter Blake, the godfather of British pop art and someone that both of us have adored since we were kids.
I've loved pop art since I was a kid, and Sir Peter Blake has been a constant for me, alongside other pop art artists, the Americans like Andy Warhol, Roy Lichtenstein, Keith Haring. And I got into pop art, Rob, because I loved cartoons growing up. I mean, I still love animation. But suddenly I discovered that so many artists were referencing comic strips and cartoons in their artworks, and I could go and see them in museums, and I suddenly didn't need to grow up. And Sir Peter Blake was one of these artists that meant so much to me. And I think people, if they don't know the name Sir Peter Blake, you would certainly know his work. The album cover for The Beatles, Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club, Oasis's Stop the Clocks. These are iconic art historical moments that this artist has actually been at the forefront of.
And you've met him, haven't you?
I've met him. Yeah, at the South Bank Show Awards years ago, I was there for the History Boys, and he was there, and I got incredibly excited and met him. But you've not met him before, have you, Rob?
I have. I've actually even been to his house and hung out with him and his wife, and I got to make an amazing print with him, which was a huge privilege, actually. It was a real career moment for me. So Budweiser and Sir Peter Blake have come together to unite, and they have created an exclusive limited edition beer can, which doubles as a collectible piece of pop art.
And it was on display at London's Truerman Brewery on the 23rd and 24th of March this year, if you were lucky enough to get there. And also, were you one of the lucky few that were able to get one of the signed beer cans by Sir Peter Blake himself? And there was something very special there, wasn't there, Rob? What was that?
They've actually made the first ever fridge frame, which kind of is reminiscent of what we would be, you know, accustomed with in terms of a museum exhibit. Yeah. But this fridge frame is designed to display the limited edition can of beer as a work of art, but also keeps the beer cool.
Okay, I need a fridge full of fridge frames because this sounds incredible. So Peter Blake's work adorns the cans with all of his eye-catching simplicity. It features the Budweiser's iconic red bow tie logo, but it's encompassed by the artist's signature and his use of block colours and icons. They unveiled this artistic can in all of its glory in one of these fridge frames, as Rob said, which is very exciting. The limited edition cans are available to purchase as a four-pack for a limited time only in selected Tesco stores nationwide.
Budweiser and Sir Peter Blake, thank you for bringing us this cultural moment. I love it when art reaches new audiences, and I really feel like this is going to go into everyone's homes, and is really joyous. So head over to Tesco, pick up a four-pack. Thank you, Budweiser.
But also, if you want to get this collectible piece of art at home, Budweiser also given people the chance to own their very own exclusive fridge frame. Beer and art lovers can register their interest by visiting www.budweiser.co.uk/Sir Peter Blake collab. That's budweiser.co.uk/Sir Peter Blake collab. Budweiser and talk art with Sir Peter Blake. Can we do a bit of role play, Robert?
Sure, of course.
So I'm coming to you. Me and my partner have just bought this house in Margate that we need to do up somewhere we can go by the sea, which is in the Kent coast in the UK. So I'm calling you up now, and I want to work with you. What sort of questions do you ask me? If I go like, hi, Robert, I'm Russell. I've got this house in Margate. I've seen your book. I think you're amazing. How could we collaborate on doing my house?
I would want to know more about the house. You know, you tell me where it's located, what kind of house is it, how big is it, what are your plans, what's your schedule, do you have any photographs, can you send me the plans? I would start with things like that.
Mm-hmm. And so, and then I say, right, okay, I've got art, but I've also got furniture that I want to put in there. Would you look at what I've got and say yes, or would you advise me to add more pieces?
He'd advise you to sell it all and start again. Joke.
I would completely look at everything that you have, and I would be completely open to using anything that I thought was good for the next phase of your life, or anything that was really important to you. And if there was anything that was debatable, like there was something that you were really holding on to that I didn't think was right, I would tell you. But I also would let you keep it. And you would then just realize much later in the process that I was right. And you'd come to me and you'd say, you know, Robert, you were right. That chair's totally wrong. We've got to get rid of it. But I would 100% indulge people. I don't like to be the dictator person. I don't think it's necessary. I think it's a process. Yeah. The whole design thing is a process. It should be fun. It should be interesting. You know, people come with stuff. Let's look at your stuff. If I hated all your stuff, I would tell you.
How do you charge for that then? So then I go, I've got this budget, or how do you budget for things?
How do I budget? Well, I just make up a budget based on, you know, past experience. how do we budget? We're very, very business oriented, and we work for all super successful business people, and we do budgets for everything. So, I mean, we'd have a budget conversation, and, you know, I might ask you if you had a budget, and, you know, if you did, that would be a starter. if you asked me how much I thought it would cost based on the information that I had, yeah. I maybe would give you a range. Or in the end, I would say that I would give you a budget that would be a preliminary budget. That would be a budget that could be potentially a little bit less, could easily be a little bit more, but it could get you the interior, an interior that's comparable to anything that you've seen that I've done.
Right. Okay. That's good. And
how do you feel? How are my answers? Am I like, what's my
grade? Your answers are great. Your answers are great. I know I've lost my thread then. I was getting involved in imagining my house looking like one of your interiors.
Sadly, I am not known to be inexpensive.
That's the question I want to ask. Can we ask a personal question? What is kind of your starting rate? If you were to take on a project, what is your sort of going rate?
Well, in the United States, you're not in the United States. In the United States, it's very difficult for us to take on a project that has a budget of less than $1 million. It's just the way that my office is set up and the way that we function, that we kind of need like $1 million interior budget.
Per job, per kind of project.
For a job, yes.
Amazing.
Wow.
But you know, but
you're major. You are royalty.
But it all depends. You know, that's also probably like, you know, like a, you know, would be for for like a house or an apartment, not a really big one, but like, you know, a decent sized one. So, you know, that's kind of like a guide. Like, you know, if somebody has, I mean, I could do a really nice 2-bedroom apartment for less than that.
Mm. Right,
extremely less.
Because the apartment costs less than that.
It depends.
And actually, one of your most well-known projects was a house that you lived in for about 18 years or so. And I think you've recently sold it. Is that right? The one in
I haven't sold it. It's on the market.
It's just come on the market. Yeah.
Yes.
And it's a 5,000 square foot house. And it looks so incredible. What was it like doing that, you know, for yourself, like a whole house, like a giant house?
It was super fun. I mean, I started building it, I guess, 20 years ago. And at the time, didn't really have that much money. So I built it on a shoestring and I built the entire structure. And then I finished the main part on the inside. And then this secondary part, which we call the barn, I completed a couple of years after that. And then it just really has like evolved over the past 18 years. You know, I moved it into 18 years ago into what it is today, what you see in those photographs. And I think, like, I don't know if you read the foreword that Mayor Russ wrote in my book, but he said that my house especially, but my apartment as well, it's like life as autobiography. And it's really quite true. I mean, like, I'm sitting in this room in my apartment, but
I'm inspired by that.
I could be sitting in any room in my house also, or another room in this apartment, and I'm surrounded by the history of my life. Like everything that I've acquired, anything that I've made, I did it. You know, like I made this cashmere bed in this guest bedroom, and then, you know, I chose the cashmere. I went to my upholsterer and I worked with them on the design. I remember the guys bringing it in who have been my movers for 22 years, and bringing in and installing it. And, you know, it's like everything has it says there's so much history and so many memories and everything. You know, it's like, you know, there's a beautiful lamp I bought in the flea market in Paris, and something I brought, you know, two tables I bought from Liz O'Brien, who's a dealer that I've known for like, I don't know, 25 years. And, you know, I've made so many friends in the business and in the, you know, same thing with the art and the art world and, you know, curators and gallerists and just all these different people. So there's so much history.
But talking about the art board, and as an avid collector, it's got you to actually become part of the council for the Whitney Museum of American Art.
Sure. Yes. I love the Whitney.
Yeah. I love the Whitney. It's one of my favorite museums in the world. How did that come about, and what is your role there, and what is your responsibilities?
I've been on the Directors Council for a long, long time, which is really just like a group of collectors who get together and like sort of talk about art. You do a lot of studio visits and there's like different trips and all that kind of stuff. And, you know, you just like have like nice access to the sort of museum, and obviously it's like you're also supporting the museum on at a very nice level. And I decided to, you know, maybe like 20 years ago or something like that, you know, I was an aspirational person. I wanted to build a business, and you can't be in business in New York and not have some kind of like social life and have like build you know, presence for yourself. You have to be out and be seen, and people want to know who you know and all that kind of stuff. And so I find a lot of that stuff to be very superficial and very fleeting and not really that appealing to me. So I decided to go and do the things that I just loved. So I was like, I like art. I'm going to pick the art world. I'm going to go and invest myself a little in the art world and get to know people and, you know, support the museums. And, you know, I support a lot of different art organizations, and it's, you know, it is gratifying. And I met a lot of, like, I've met over the years many like very interesting, cool people that I've now known for 20 years. And it's just been a mutually beneficial thing for, you know, the art organizations and for me.
And I heard you had a really inspiring friendship with Beth Rudin de Woody and her family.
100%,
and for those
absolutely.
Who don't know, she's like one of the best collectors ever and very positive people in the world. She's a wonderful influence. Can you speak a bit about her and the impact she had on your life?
Well, the way that I met her, which is about 20 years ago, is I'd hired this PR person in New York to help me get new clients. And like, you know, I was like, I don't need you to get me published. I already know all the editors. They like my work. If I have a project that's good for them, they're going to publish it. But I want you to introduce me to clients. So it was really expensive. And I did it for like, you know, a long time. And I was sort of getting to the end of my rope, and she knew it. And she said to me, any chance you're going to go to Palm Beach this weekend? And I said, yeah, actually I am. And she said, okay. She's like, well, I want you to go to this luncheon. It's for John Loring, who used to be the design director at Tiffany's. He's a very, very nice man. I think he just had a book out. It was a luncheon, blah, 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 blah. Again, not so much my thing, but I was like, okay, fine, I'll go. So I go, and mind you, I had already lived in Palm Beach at that point I didn't live there anymore, but I'd sort of been spending a lot of time there for already 15, 16 years. And I go to this luncheon, and I'm seated next to Beth. And we basically, after 5 minutes, just spent the entire lunch talking to each other and completely didn't pay attention to any speeches or anything anybody said or whatever. And that was the beginning of our friendship. So my joke is that I paid $60,000 to become friends with Beth. And she tells that story too. But it's true. But it was so ironic because I spent all these years in Palm Beach and I never knew her. And I think back to like my experiences there and how it would have been so different had I known her. But, you know, she then just is a person that had a profound effect on me in the sense that at that point in my life, I was still I had a much more limited outlook and view at life. I had blinders on and I was very specific about what I liked and what I didn't like. And she taught me to open my eyes. And, you know, it was like, before I met her, if I didn't like the way that a shop looked, I wouldn't go in. And she'd be like, let's go in. You don't know what you're going to find. I was like, okay, fine. And then, you know, lo and behold, you go in and there's the back of the store, this ugly, tacky place has some amazing thing that you can't believe they ever had. And, you know, she just a lot of things like that. And she has such sort of like bravery with confidence in terms of like doing what she likes and believes in. And, and she's very inclusive. She also, to me, is a real collector. She, you know, she buys art every single day. And she's not a person who consults ArtNet or any of those things before she makes a purchase. She, you know, she has a lot of knowledge. So that's great. But like she does a version of what I said I do. She looks at it. She likes it. She asks the price. If she thinks it's fair, she pays it. If she thinks it's expensive, she asks for a better price. And, you know, blah, 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 blah. But like she makes the deal and then she moves on to the next thing. There's no like, oh, I don't know. I'm not sure. Let me see. I've got to talk to my accountant. I have to like, you know, I got to see how it sold at auction and this and that. And it's like, it's a $5,000 piece of art. You don't really need to do all that stuff. It's not, you know, if it's a $50 million piece, okay, fine. But, you know, people overdo so much of all this stuff and make the fun of it not that much fun. She has fun.
Yeah. And also, I think buying what you love and having confidence in what you love is a really important thing, isn't it? And you must have 100%. That, you know, having confidence in your own vision, you know,
I was just with her last week down in Palm Beach, and she was like, come over to my warehouse. She just got this new warehouse where she's kind of like putting, it's going to be a lot of art, but well, she's trying to like reduce her inventory of like antique and vintage furniture. And she's like, I want to get rid of all this stuff. She like literally, it's just like what I was saying about me, this history of her life. She's like, I bought this here and I bought this there and I did this. Da, da, da. It's fascinating. Like, and it's just always interesting. And she has such passion for it. I love that.
Do you still have a bucket list for like work, the projects that you want to create in the future and for things that you want to acquire and be around?
I mean, I think for projects, I have yet to do a hotel, which I would love to do that. What I really would love to do is like design my own sort of like group of hotels and like all the places that I like to go to the most and design, you know, a unique hotel for each place. That would be super fun. I would like to work in Europe and I'd like to have European clients in Europe, or they could be American clients too, but I actually would prefer to have European clients.
You should come to Margate, Robert. Absolutely.
You need to do Russell's new house in Margate.
There you go.
I can't give you $1 million though. Sorry, mate. It's more than the actual house.
We could talk.
Have you ever had any nightmares? Any nightmare clients? Anyone that's just been like horror stories?
I have a couple. Not many, but a few.
Can you tell us one?
Like, I mean, I can't name names.
No.
I had one client who is a well-known person who she did this thing where she would come to the meetings and we would have a whole presentation ready for her and she would say, I went shopping too. And I would say, okay. So she'd pull out her stuff and she'd go through all her stuff and then she would be sitting there on the table next to mine and she'd say, I like mine better. Do you mind?
No way.
I'm like, so eventually we just kept saying, okay, fine. And we're a shopping service basically to her. And she wouldn't listen to anything. I went to Europe with her. I was like, you know, you could get this chair. Nope, I got to get that one. Blah, 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 blah. It comes to the installation and we're installing it. And I'm not there that particular day or whatever. I'm at the office and she called me. She's like, we have a problem. So I go over there. She's like, I don't like this. She's like, I don't like this chair. I'm like, you picked that chair. She's like, I don't like this. I'm like, you don't like it. Like you didn't listen to anything that I said. Like you picked all this stuff yourself. She's like, but I hired you to protect me. I said, I tried to tell you and you didn't listen to me.
Oh, so, wow. That is,
that was the end of that. I was happy.
Did she still pay? Did she still pay you for your time and everything? Or how does that all work after that?
Yeah, pretty much. Mostly there was like a few things that, you know, she didn't like, she should have paid for them 100%, but I just wanted to take the high road and end it nicely. So maybe I like ate one thing or two things and moved on.
And I read somewhere that your dream client who you haven't worked with yet, but you would like to work with was Lady Gaga. Is that
true?
I would
love to work with her. Absolutely. No, very much.
Awesome. And why Gaga? I love her, by the way.
I mean, she's just a person that's appealing to me. It's like, there's plenty of people that it would be interesting and fascinating to work with. I'm interested in creative people. And I think in my career, creative people, like entrepreneurial people, people who know how to recognize talent and creativity and hire people and let them do their job, they're the best clients. I don't want to have a client who just, like some people think that the best client ever is someone who's just like, oh, here's $10 million. I'll see you in a year. That's also the worst client. That's such a crapshoot. How would you ever know? And everything, single thing that I told you about how I do these interiors that, you know, some people love.
It's a collaboration. It's
like by spending time with people. Like, so if they just disappear and give me a bunch of money, like it's who knows what it's going to turn out to be.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And your son's gone into the business.
He has. He's works in, for a company called Ash, which does staging, which has become very, very, very popular here. I think it's popular in England too. And he is the director of operation for the staging of Ash, which is a pretty big business. And he's going to be 26 years old and he's doing great. Yeah, I'm very proud.
Can you explain what staging is?
A staging is if you had an apartment or a house in Margate that you were trying to sell and it wasn't selling, your real estate broker would come to you and say like, Russell or Robert, you should stage this. And you, they come in and they basically decorate.
What they do in American Beauty, what she does in American Beauty, where they kind of make the house look livable.
Yeah, exactly.
Your interior,
exactly.
So someone can walk in and go, this is a lifestyle. Right.
Exactly. Basically, they make it look good to sell it. My son, Dylan's company, happens to be one of the very few that's really good at it. And they actually make it look like it's, you know, really like Architectural Digest worthy, kind of in a way. In fact, they're the only firm that does that kind of stuff that's on the Architectural Digest 80-100. So they're very good at it. It's very aesthetic and really very, very good looking and appealing. And they have a very good success rate with their work actually selling the houses or the apartments.
Does he come to you for advice?
Sure, of course. Absolutely.
That's nice.
And sometimes I go to him for advice.
You do? That's great.
You do? That's so cool.
I bet he must feel really humbled by that.
Yeah, definitely.
Oh. Although he's the new generation.
Mentoring each other.
He can give you a different perspective. So what is it like to... I noticed that you'd had like a decade now of being in Elle Decor's top 25 A-list designers.
Sure.
Is there a secret to your kind of the longevity in your career?
I mean, I think it's really just hard work, a lot of hard work. You know, we work very, very hard. My business, what I do, is a luxury. Nobody has to do it. There's a lot of people who do it. And, you know, it's about service and doing a great job at it. But it's not just about, like, you know, making it all look beautiful. It's about getting it done on time and getting it done on budget and, you know, all those kind of things. And I take all that stuff very, very seriously. And I'm a hard worker and my team all works super hard. And I feel like, you know, I'm always evolving as a human being and I'm evolving as an interior designer and a creative person. And, you know, you just have to kind of like, I don't ever feel like I have to be one step ahead, but I guess maybe like I kind of am one step ahead in that sense. Yeah. And, you know, and thanks to people like Beth, who taught me to be a more courageous person, you know, she's a wonderful mentor to me. Like I have, you know, at 55 years old, developed that ability at some point in the, I don't know, past to be able to like just do that. And, you know, people really at the level that I'm working, if they're buying confidence. They want you to be confident. They want you to give them straight answers. I'm good at what I do and I love doing it, which I think, you know, is the biggest key of all. If you love what you do, my dad told me, if you love what you do, it'll never feel like work and you'll always be successful.
Love that. I also heard a word that your friends described your projects as being authentic beyond anything else. And I think that authenticity is also why people would trust, you know, because it's a lot of trust to spend that money to like, you know, to let you into their private world, all of these things. But
I spend my clients' money like it's my own money. I mean, I really do. I tell everyone who works for me, I say, like, you know, if you get a quote for something and you think it's really expensive, our clients are going to think it's really expensive too. Because our clients, for the most part, are all self-made people. They're all hardworking people. And I've also, it's, you know, another thing that I've just learned over the past 30 years of this career is, like, I feel like, for me anyway, like, we attract what we are. And my clients are another version of me. You know, they're all, like, some of them came from nothing. Some of them came from a nice family, had a good education, but, you know, nobody got a trust fund or whatever. And everybody, we all went out there. We worked hard. We followed our dreams and our passions. And, you know, we're all lucky enough to be successful at whatever level of success that we have. And so everybody, all my clients, like, no matter if they're a billionaire or whatever they are, they all value things there's just like a realness to the whole thing. And I never, ever lose sight of that.
Right on. Love that. Well, Robert, we ask every guest that comes on two very important questions. The first one is, if you could do an art heist, you could do an imaginary theft of any work of art in the world, it could be any size, a building, a painting, a sculpture, a car, what would it be and why?
Okay, well, normally when I get asked those kinds of questions, I say I don't know because there's so many choices. But I decided to really step up to the plate today and really make a choice.
Thank you.
And so I was thinking about just my life and art and my exposure to it and all that kind of thing. And the one, you know, because I have this rule also about art. Like if I see something and maybe it's a little too expensive or I'm just not sure, whatever, like I just live with it. And like if I keep thinking about it every day, then at some point, like I know, like I should buy that piece of art. So that's one of my tests. So I was thinking of applying that to myself and this question. And, you know, what's, you know, one piece of art that has just been in the back of my head my whole life or for since my adult life. And I would have to say it's a Cy Twombly chalkboard.
And, really?
Yeah. I remember in the late 80s getting to go to a really, I think, extraordinary house in Palm Beach. It was owned by this man named Howard Gittes, who was Ron Perlman's right-hand man. It was decorated by a gentleman who's dead now. His name is Kevin McNamara. It was very like this beautiful Coquina, Maurice Fascio house built in the 20s, completely restored, but like, you know, it had every convenience of 1988, but at the same time, it was an old house, incredible property, beautiful pool. It had guests east and guests west. And, you know, this is 35 years ago. I was like so impressed. And it was just so rich and chic and elegant. And you walk into this huge drawing room with coffered ceilings that are all painted and whatever. And, you know, it's very like, you know, elegant and deep, rich colors and a lot of prints and, you know, more traditional decor, but like right on this gigantic wall was the biggest Cy Twombly chalkboard I ever saw in my life. And I was like, oh my God, I want that. And I
they're incredibly like love it to timeless, this day. Timeless works, aren't they? Because you can't quite work out when they are because they're so like modern and futuristic, but at the 100%. Same time they have this like soulful kind of connection to the past or the human condition or something. They're very complex actually, those works.
Yeah. And if I had to do the heist, it would be fun to steal it from that house.
And it's still in that house. Yeah, yeah.
No, I don't know. I would just hypothetically, if I was going to steal it, I would. Yeah, we could go back and I could steal it from that house.
Love.
That would be fun.
Very
cool. It was very chic house that had a big impact on me actually in terms of design. And I don't think it was ever even published.
Amazing. But sometimes that happens. You turn up a collector's house. Rob's taken me to various collector's houses in the past, and you walk in and you're like, oh my God, this is what it can be like. This is how you can live with art properly. It's amazing.
Absolutely. Yep.
And they 100%. Affect you.
I was almost wondering whether you were going to say a sculpture, because there's something, definitely a thread in your interior designs, where a lot of the furniture itself can become quite sculptural.
Absolutely.
And you seem to have a real affinity to, even like your shelving units, I've noticed, and like the shapes of a lot of the chairs. Yes, they look very comfortable, but from the side of them, you often have these kind of metal frames or, you know, very sculptural.
Yes, you're 100% right. Yeah.
Elements.
And I care very much about that. But if they're not comfortable, they don't get included.
Yeah. Cool. The other question we ask every guest is, what is your favorite color?
I mean, probably like net all the way around, my favorite color is navy.
Navy?
Mm.
Navy, yeah. Mm. I like to live house and my apartment are most of the fabrics that are in my house and apartment are navy and brown. Then some usually with like a punch of color, like a beautiful like burnt orange or a burn very deep red, but not a lot. I also happen to like a really, really, really dark green, but navy and brown are my favorites.
Navy's my favorite
color for clothes also.
Yeah. Well, I've seen a lot of pictures of you in navy with like sexy posed with your bare feet out. Looking all
crazy. You often have your feet out.
Having said that, you asked me
everyone's seen your favorite feet.
You asked me what my favorite was, but I love color too. I love lavender and, you know, I like a lot of different colors that I like pink. And we do a lot more color in for clients than I do necessarily personally for myself. But
yeah. What do you think of this navy kitchen trend that seems to be everywhere at the moment?
I feel like I started it. I did my kitchen that way 20 years ago.
Did you?
My kitchen actually
100 royalty right here
is not it's not navy, it's actually the deepest brown right before you get to black, but the dark color. I love dark kitchens, and there's a bunch in my book. I think
they're
fantastic.
There is, totally.
And, but for me it's not a trend. Like to me it's so timeless. Like my kitchen, which is in the book, is 20 years old, and it looks fantastic.
One of my favorite spaces you've done is with that Rothko painting in a bedroom, and you've got right. this kind of beautiful red bed, and then a kind of almost like linen sort of lilac lamp shade. And I was obsessed right. with that lampshade for some reason.
Oh, so cool.
It's really beautiful installation.
That Where bed, I actually, that? I did, that was a custom bed that I did with Maria Perguet, who yes. I adore. She's an incredible person. And I used to go to, I would go to Paris while we were doing that, and I'd meet her at a cafe outside on, you know, on the side of the street. And she would just draw all these fanciful drawings on like a cocktail napkin, which basically wow. became the drawing for that bed, which was not inexpensive. And
but you have a shop as well, don't you?
I used to have a shop in the Hamptons. I started as a shopkeeper. At the moment, I have a shop at 200 Lexington. They on the 10th floor, they have kind of like, it's sort of similar to a flea market in the sense that there's like 65 dealers. Everybody has a small space. And you know, I have like a, maybe like a 800 square foot space there. Yeah.
What, and you go around picking things for that?
Yeah, yes.
Yourself?
I do.
I also saw that you, don't you sell things on First Dibs as well, the website?
I do, First Dibs, InCollect, yes.
Mm. What was that second one? What one? I don't know that one.
InCollect, yes.
Okay, don't know that.
InCollect. I'll look that up. And I also saw that you curated a show for Sotheby's at one point.
I have done that, yes, absolutely.
What was that like as an experience? Was that challenging or exciting?
And it was really interesting. It was fun to do. I really enjoyed it. And I've done a lot of things like that where you're sort of given, you have to pick from a certain amount of things and you have to just make it work. So it's like you can do whatever you want, but there's limitations. It was interesting. The part that I remember the most was just dealing with the infrastructure of Sotheby's, which is just so antiquated, and all their rules with the union, and you can't touch this and don't touch that. And I'm used to touching everything. It's like, I like that. Let's try it here. I pick it up. I don't care. Like, yeah. You can't touch that. You can't touch this. You can't touch that. That was not easy for me, but it was a good experience, and everyone was super nice, and I enjoyed doing it. I also just recently did a similar kind of thing at Mogen Gallery in New York, which is currently up right now, actually, and that was really fun. And it was the same thing. I mean, they sent myself and two other designers, we each got like a third of the gallery, and they sent us their entire inventory, and they're like, you know, pick anything wow. you want, make it into a room. So it was fun.
Wow, I'd love that. So you're yeah. basically a curator, aren't you?
Yeah, for sure, 100%. And I would like to do wow. that. You know, you asked like what kinds of things would I like to do. I would like to do, I like doing that stuff, and I would like to do more of that. I love, you know, curating design and art and just kind of everything, and showing people how you can live with art. And like, that's, I do think, you know, one of the nice things about my book in particular is it does show people like, yeah, you can live with art. And I mean, like, you should live with it. Like, you should drink your coffee. You should have parties. You should have sex. You should whatever, like live with it. If you can't enjoy it, don't do it. That's how I feel, you know.
Yeah, and I think I used to find it all quite intimidating. Like, you'd go to, I used to go to houses in like LA when I first started working at the gallery, and you just felt like you couldn't touch anything, or even like right. they'd give you a glass of water and you couldn't put the water down anywhere
yeah.
because it was so pristine and like, I don't know, just so over the top, and everything felt like it was so valuable. But I think what I love about what you do is that you can have all these expensive objects, but they look like domestic, you know, wonderful, rich interiors that you can, yeah, yeah exactly.
So well, I always say to my client, I'm like, do you want to live in a museum?
Yeah.
Like, if you really, yeah. if that's what you want, if you want like one chair and one lamp and two tables and a lot of huge paintings and, you know, all, everything's white and all that, like, great. It's not a very enjoyable life. It's not comfortable. It's just, it's just, you're living in an institution. And I think that's why we have institutions. So I just tell them, like, build a museum.
Yeah, yeah, instead of doing Absolutely. It in your home.
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
It's just made me think about something. When we were talking about set design and like your apartment's looking like staging, and we talked about staging, and it makes me think of like the theatre, like as an actor as well. But I'm looking around my house now doing this, and I think, you know what? I feel like you kind of cast the interior of your house, and you have like your lead actors and actresses, and then you have your supporting parts. So like, I've got this big table here, and I'd say that's my lead actor, and the couch is obviously a lead actor, and then you have like the lamp, which is a supporting actress, or you have like the chairs, which are supporting the table. Does that sort of element play into your thinking when you create a space?
It's something that I've come to realize in my life, you know, in the reflective phase, that it's like a dance. And but you could say exactly what you just said. You could say it's characters in a play or a movie or whatever. Yeah. And every piece is, it's like you bought the sofa. That's a supporting actor. You bought the stunning chair. That's one of the superstars or whatever. You know, like all these different things. And then every time you make a choice, it informs your other choice. And then, you know, in the end, it creates, I always say it creates this dance, and everything is sort of playing off of each other. And it might be exactly what you had in your mind when you started. Most often it's what you had in your mind, but just better. Especially if you're really willing to like put yourself out there and take some chances and, you know, not be like, you know, too conservative and all that sort of stuff. In my experience, most of the time it works out to be even better than I expected. And I think the clients would say the same thing. But it is. That's a very accurate way to put it, 100%.
Yeah, I've just sort of realized that. But what an amazing hour and a bit talking to you, Robert. And
yeah, thank you so
absolutely.
Much.
My pleasure.
And we will share images on our Instagram of all
fantastic.
These different interiors. Including the ones you did.
Everyone should get
galleries.
Your book, Robert Stillin
yes.
Interiors.
And actually, there's a signed version of the book at the moment on the publisher's website, where the money, I think $10 from each book, is actually going to a COVID charity.
Yes, that's true. Absolutely. To the
very cool
God's Love We Deliver, which feeds people in general, specifically people with HIV and AIDS and all that kind of stuff, but like they would feed anybody.
Amazing. Mm-hmm.
Amazing.
Yeah, so we'll also
do a lot of great outreach and all that kind of stuff. It's an amazing place.
Awesome. And are you on Instagram? Well, you are on Instagram.
I am on Instagram, of course.
We both follow you. But it's just at Robert Stillin.
Oh, yeah. Yes. You'll see it. And if you do follow it, you'll just see that every picture is liked by Russell Tovey, liked by
Thank you, Russell. Like.
Yes, I'm your biggest fan. And then hopefully we'll see you in Margate next year for my
Absolutely.
New house, yeah.
Looking forward to it.
We'll talk budgets when we get off the line here. And then,
100%.
Well, thank you so much.
Okay, my pleasure.
Great fun.
Cheers, Robert.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening. We'll be back very
soon. Have a great holiday.
Bye.
Take care. Bye. You've been listening to Talk Art with Robert Diamond and Russell Tovey.
Follow us on Instagram @TalkArt, where you can view images of all artworks discussed in today's episode, with music by Jack Northover.
Subscribe to Talk Art at Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Acast, or wherever it is that you get your podcasts.
Give us a rating and write us a comment. Thanks for listening.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.